I've always struggled with finding time to manage my finances. At the end of a busy week, the last thing I want to do is spend time budgeting all of my expenses or tracking down customer service teams to cancel old subscriptions I no longer use. But now I use Rocket Money, and it does all that for me. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so you can grow your savings. Stop wasting money on the things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Washington Post. That's rocketmoney.com/Washington Post.
I need one of you guys on the south side, one of you guys on the north side, hold all traffic on the Key Bridge. There's a ship approaching that just lost their steering. So until you get that under control, we got to stop all traffic.
What you're hearing is tape from the Maryland Transportation Authority police channel, recorded very early Tuesday morning.
F4L, I'm en route to the south side.
This is West direction.
I'm holding traffic now. I was driving, but we stopped prior to the bridge. So I'll have all out-of-loop traffic stopped.
10-4, is there a crew working on the bridge right now?
Investigators are still piecing together what happened in the last moments before a massive cargo ship crashed into a bridge in Baltimore. Today, we heard authorities are turning to a salvage operation to remove wreckage from the river. All of the 6 people who are presumed dead in this disaster were workers. They were on the bridge in the middle of the night doing their jobs to maintain the bridge.
You know, one really big question I have is how preventable was this, right?
My colleague Teo Armas has been reporting on the fallout from this horrible incident. And he's been talking to the family members of the people who died, all of whom, as far as we know, were immigrants from Latin America.
And, you know, I think the picture that we've gotten so far is one that is in many ways really representative of a particular kind of immigrant experience in the U.S., right? Of people who come to this country in their late teens or 20s and, you know, work these really tough, demanding jobs. You know, I mean, overnight in the cold on the top of a bridge.
From the newsroom of The Washington Post, this is Post Reports. I'm Martine Powers. It's Thursday, March 28th. Today, we walk through everything we know so far about what led to the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge. And I talk with Teo about the victims and how their stories tell us something larger about the vulnerability of immigrant workers. So at this point, what do we know about how many people were on the bridge at the time of the collapse? And what do we know about the recovery of their remains?
Yeah, so there were 8 people on the bridge at the time of the collapse. 2 of those people have been recovered. One suffered serious injuries. The other person actually just kind of walked away after they were recovered. Of the other 6, 2 people's bodies have been recovered. They were found in a red pickup truck yesterday. 2 other people who are presumed dead have been identified. And then there's another 2 people whose names we're still waiting on at this point.
And what have officials said about those casualties?
Yeah, so, you know, at this point, given the conditions that we're looking at in the river, it has very rapidly shifted from a search and rescue mission to a recovery mission to something that is now known as a salvage mission, particularly with the bodies of the people who have not been recovered yet. You know, we're talking about really murky conditions, really cold conditions. So it's a really tricky situation to actually be able to go and you know, recover human remains at this point.
And we heard Governor Wes Moore talk about that.
We need to bring a sense of closure and comfort to the families, and we take that very seriously.
At this point, it seems like the question on everyone's minds is what caused this crash. And obviously, investigators are trying to figure that out. They're piecing together the events that led up to the collision. Can you explain what do we know about the timeline of what transpired in the minutes before this shipping vessel collided with this bridge?
Absolutely. So everything really happened in the span of about 5 minutes. basically the ship, the Dolly, it lost power. The pilot guiding the ship out of the port of Baltimore ordered its rudder turned hard to the left and its left anchor dropped, basically to just try and slow the vessel and stop it from swinging to the right.
And before you go on, like, do we know why the ship lost power? What are the possibilities here?
People are still trying to figure that out. At this point, you know, a colleague of ours has heard from a number of sources that it may have been dirty gas that, you know, is commonly used in shipping vessels and sort of may have ultimately led to this electrical failure on the ship.
And wait, when you use the term dirty gas, like, what exactly is that?
Yeah, so dirty gas or dirty fuel, this is according to reporting from our colleague Joel Achenbach. He called it the sort of witch's brew of industrial products that, you know, might end up in marine fuel. And that's ultimately, you know, what can lead to engine failures. You know, depending on where you're getting the fuel from, it might have been contaminated with stuff like water or dirt or algae. And that can, you know, then sort of screw up how the ship works.
And then beyond this issue of potentially dirty gas, was there any indication that the ship was in poor repair, or are there maintenance records of any other malfunctions on the ship?
Yeah, so that's something that transportation officials are trying to figure out right now. They're looking at the black box of the ship, which is going to be able to offer some clues on, you know, how the ship was functioning.
The NTSB will later convene a group of technical experts to review the entire VDR recording and develop a detailed transcript of the dialogue and the events and the event alarms as recorded.
There are some inspection records that say that it did previously have problems. There is a deficiency in its systems that was discovered during an inspection last June. And inspectors at this port in Chile found this problem that is related to propulsion and auxiliary machinery.
So it sounds like the people on the ship realized the ship had lost power. They could see the bridge ahead and were trying to slow down the ship or turn the ship. And then they tried to take some measures to stop or slow the ship. Describe what happened there.
Yeah. So you might have seen this security video that kind of showed lights on the ship flickering on and off, sort of highlighting the power problem. And, you know, then this sort of thick smoke coming out, you know, from the ship. Based on our reporting at this point, I think what's likely to happen is that there was sort of a backup generator that kicked in when the power went out. And that's sort of, you know, ultimately what causing the lights to sort of turn on and off. And that, you know, I mean, all of this is happening within literally a matter of minutes. But that was basically happening as this emergency message was being sent from the ship, you know, over to land.
And we heard a little bit of the response from authorities who stopped traffic to the bridge at the beginning of the show. But let's listen to a little bit more of this and the communications that were happening at this moment.
Yeah, if we can stop traffic, just make sure no one's on the bridge right now. I'm not sure where there's a crew up there. You might want to notify whoever the foreman is, see if we can get them off the bridge temporarily.
10-4, once the other unit gets here, I'll ride up on the bridge. I have all interloop traffic stopped at this time. Once you get here, I'll go grab the workers on the key bridge and then stop the outer loop.
C-13 dispatch, the whole bridge just fell down. Start whoever, everybody. The whole bridge just collapsed.
Teo, I'm curious what you hear when you hear how this played out in communications.
I mean, I think the sort of resounding narrative at this point is that people, you know, to some degree did what they had to do and they did what they were able to do. I mean, obviously this whole terrible accident happened really quickly, but people also responded really quickly. You know, the pilot who had more than a decade of experience, you know, as soon as he realized that this was about to happen or could be about to happen, radioed this emergency message. Then you had these sort of transportation patrol officers on either side of the bridge acting immediately to, you know, prevent people from driving on the bridge. The thing that's really tricky here, and you know, you hear them talk about this construction crew that's on the bridge and, you know, trying to get those folks off. That's the one part that they were unable to do. They were, I believe, you know, waiting on a third officer who could sort of keep traffic from going on the bridge, who could sort of keep holding traffic on one side so that that officer could then drive onto the bridge and get the crew off. But this all happened so quickly that that wasn't able to happen.
Yeah, that was my feeling, too. Like, just how quickly all of this starts to unravel. And I know that we heard the tape in two different sections, but when you sit down and listen to it from beginning to end, it's really just a matter of 2 minutes that elapsed in that tape. So do you have a sense of how much of anything was communicated to these workers and whether they were on the radio or had an initial set of information that they were in the path of danger?
I think it's hard for me to answer that at this point. I'm not sure if they themselves received that message or if that was something that these officers kind of positioned on either side of the bridge were sort of able to communicate to them. You know, I think at one point they talked about sort of trying to get in touch with the foreman of the crew, but whether or not they were able to do that is a genuine question that I have.
And how fast was the ship going when it hit the bridge?
It was about 7 knots, which is about 8 miles an hour. So, you know, not super fast, but again, we're talking about this just really massive cargo ship. And, you know, ultimately when something like this just hits, you know, part of a support system, a lot of experts that our colleagues talked to basically said this was bound to happen. There is no way when something with this force traveling at, you know, that speed hits the bridge for this not to fall down in the way that it did.
Interesting. So there's not a sense right now that the bridge was in some state of disrepair or that it should have been in a position to be able to, like, handle an impact like that, that the experts are saying that the size of that ship and the speed that it was going, that it, even in the best case scenario, that this bridge would have fallen down.
Yeah, this type of bridge specifically, I think there's have been some debate and sort of some questions within the engineering world about what kinds of supports and protections the bridge should have. You know, you look at some other bridge, I believe there was actually a debate around this specific bridge around, you know, whether to sort of set up these supports below on the water closer to the support structures to sort of protect those and, you know, prevent those from being hit by a ship, as happened in this situation. But, you know, obviously that never happened. And I think that's going to be that and sort of the overall design is going to be a really big source of debate moving forward, I would say, you know, as officials start to, you know, look to rebuild this whole thing.
And we've also seen news about potential hazardous materials that are entering into the water around the ship. What are those hazardous materials? Where are they coming from? And, like, how big a problem is that?
Yeah, so there's about 1.5 million gallons of oil, I believe, that were being, you know, carried by the ship. Mm. There are a number of cargo containers as well that I think have at this point sort of fallen into the river. Almost, you know, 5,000 cargo containers and some of them, again, carrying hazardous materials. The chair of that safety board, you know, I think at some point had said that there's sort of a film collecting on the river.
Some of the hazmat containers were breached. We have seen sheen on the waterway. The federal, state, and local authorities are aware of that, and they will be in charge of addressing those issues.
But it's a really difficult operation to, you know, get both the ship itself, which seems to be kind of stuck to the bottom of the river, and then also the pieces of the collapsed bridge, like, out of the water.
And of course, then there's the question of trying to get this port back open now that this bridge is basically blocking ships from being able to get in and out. How quickly is it anticipated that there can be a solution to that of getting the port back running? And what kind of effect is it going to have in the meantime, the fact that this major American port is essentially non-operable?
Yeah, I mean, the port is really the lifeblood of Baltimore in a lot of ways. You know, we're talking about 20,000 jobs. If you kind of zoom out further and look at indirect connections, there's about 100,000 people who, you know, really depend on the port or something related to the port in some sense. That's according to the Longshoremen Union there. So it's, you know, a lot of economic activity. I mean, the bridge itself also, you know, was sort of really vital in connecting Baltimore County to Anne Arundel County, which, you know, is across the water. It's sort of this major transit route. There's some neighborhoods that are, you know, a little bit more stranded. There's going to be a lot of traffic. I mean, we're talking about, like, a really vital part of Baltimore's economy. And then if we're also looking at the broader supply chain outside of Maryland, outside of Baltimore, this port is also really important for the movement of cars, construction machinery, and also coal and even tofu, actually. So, you know, this is sort of a really important gateway for a lot of those particular products to kind of then, you know, be disseminated throughout the supply chain, you know, go from point A to point B. And that is, you know, something that consumers and industry are sort of going to feel, I think, you know, further down the line. President Biden and, you know, I think other federal officials have made it clear that, you know, they're going to foot the bill to rebuild this bridge as fast as they can. But I mean,
we heard Secretary of Transportation Buttigieg say this the other day, basically making this promise.
While the investigation and the response continue, President Biden has made clear that this whole administration will be providing support in every respect for the recovery and the rebuilding process. From a Department of Transportation perspective, that really comes down to four major focus areas. Reopen the port, deal with the supply chain implications until the port does reopen, rebuild the bridge, and deal with the surface transportation implications until the bridge is rebuilt.
It's going to take a while, though, you know, right? I mean, I think a lot of people have been talking about the I-95 bridge, this highway bridge in Philly that collapsed and was rebuilt, you know, in a matter of 2 weeks, much faster than anyone thought that it could be built. That's a bridge over land. This is, you know, a bridge that goes into deep water. It's a much more complicated process. And so I think we're looking at different timelines from different experts, but, you know, some people say it's going to be a matter of weeks or months to get all the stuff that is sort of blocking the port and, you know, preventing ships from coming in, preventing some ships that are at the port from coming out, and you know, clear that route up. And then, you know, I mean, it could be a matter of years at this point before the bridge itself is reconstructed. So there's kind of, you know, two different phases of it is, you know, getting the port back up and running and then getting the bridge or, you know, whatever replaces it back up and running as well.
After the break, we turn to Teo's reporting on the lives of the people who were on that bridge and the families they left behind. We'll be right back.
I've always struggled with finding time to manage my finances. At the end of a busy week, the last thing I want to do is spend time budgeting all of my expenses or tracking down customer service teams to cancel old subscriptions I no longer use. But now I use Rocket Money, and it does all that for me. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so you can grow your savings. Stop wasting money on the things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Washington Post. That's rocketmoney.com/Washington Post.
Hey, this is Christina Quinn. I'm the host of Try This, the Washington Post's new series of audio courses. The idea behind Try This is to become better functioning humans without having to comb the internet for countless hours. In our first course, we learned how to sleep better. Now, we're going to learn how to make our friendships stronger. I'll offer expert tips that are doable, and I'll keep it short. So let's do this. Class is in session. Find Try This from the Washington Post wherever you listen.
So, Teo, I want to go back to the construction workers who were on that bridge at the moment of collision. As you said, some of their remains have been recovered. Some of them have not yet been recovered. But who were these people?
Yeah. So we're, you know, still, again, like I said, waiting on some names and I think waiting on more identifying information for a couple of those people. As far as we know, most of them were working for this contractor, Bronner Builders. They were all or almost all immigrants from Mexico and Central America. And my colleagues and I have, you know, basically been working really hard over the last couple of days to get in touch with family members to just, you know, try and paint a picture of who they were. Some of them, you know, had been in the U.S. for a decade, two decades. Most of them were fathers to young children. They were married. They were family men. You know, I talked to the nephew of one of the workers, Maynard Suiso Sandoval, you know, who said his uncle had been in the U.S. for 17 years, has a wife he met here, a 5-year-old daughter, but, you know, has been working in construction and, you know, driving a truck and, I mean, doing these jobs that are just so vital to making a city like Baltimore run for the entire time that he's been here.
And I think we have some tape of your conversation with his nephew. Can you introduce him and talk a little bit about what you guys spoke about over the phone?
Yeah. So I talked to his nephew, who's still in Honduras.
Y usted, usted se llama Héctor Guardado, ¿no? ¿Cierto?
Sí.
Okay.
His name is Héctor Guardado. And, you know, he very graciously, in like a really horrific moment for his family, basically just took some time to tell me a little bit about his uncle, who, you know, was from the Santa Barbara department of Honduras. And, I mean, really just painted this picture of a man who was so devoted to his family.
Pues, ¿qué le puedo decir? Una gran persona, un tipo luchador.
Sí.
Cariñoso, que apoyaba a su familia en todas las circunstancias de la vida.
So what he was saying there is, what can I tell you? He was a great person, a fighting guy, he was kind, and he supported his family in all of life's circumstances. On birthdays and baptisms and weddings, any kind of family occasion, he would buy cake for his relatives.
Él estaba presto, él quería dar un pastel, él quería mandar una cosa, hagamos esto, hagamos el otro.
You know, we're talking about someone who does not make a lot of money, but, you know, would consistently send back money to support, like, a youth soccer league in the town that he grew up in.
Así que él mandaba dinero para los uniformes o compraba los uniformes directamente.
Sí, él mandaba para aquí, aquí se hacían las compras.
Was a really big soccer fan himself.
Era muy hincha, seguidor del club Motagua de Honduras. Era muy aficionado.
Okay.
A lot of the family photos that they sent over show him wearing a jersey for his favorite team from Honduras.
And is Minor one of the individuals whose remains has been recovered yet, or
no?
Muy duro para la familia y sí. Y pues esperando pueda ser encontrado el cuerpo al menos.
They're saying, you know, this has been really hard for the family, and that they're hoping that they can find his body at the very least, which in Central America in particular is super, super important. I talked quite a bit with Héctor about, you know, his hope that the family would you know, be able to have Minor's body back in Honduras so that they could, you know, bury him there. He had, you know, talked ever since he left Honduras about being able to, you know, one day return and see mm-hmm. his mom and see his, you know, family that he left behind there.
Él siempre dijo de que él deseaba regresar a su país.
He's just hoping he'll make it back at some point, even if it's in a casket.
Si no con vida, pues, siquiera su cuerpo, ¿me entiendes? Puede ser repatriado.
I can't imagine how hard this moment must be for his family. I'm curious if you have any larger takeaways about the fact that these victims were all workers who were working on this bridge, and the fact that all of them were from Central America and from Mexico.
Yeah, I think this sort of really underscores this truth, you know, a reality that people like Héctor himself underscored, you know, that we're talking about some of the people who are, you know, often the most vulnerable, putting themselves, you know, on the line for their families to do these really difficult jobs. Yet they're also the least protected in a lot of ways. According to some of the reporting our colleagues did, there's about 130,000 immigrant workers who work in construction in the Baltimore and D.C. region. And that's almost 40% of the construction workforce in this area. If we zoom out nationally, foreign-born Latino workers are about 8.2% of the overall workforce, but they face a disproportionate number of deaths. They account for about 14% of workplace deaths. And sort of the threat that they face, you know, the dangers that they face have also been increasing. You know, about a decade ago, we were looking at 512 deaths a year, and that has risen to, you know, more than 700 in 2021. So it's, you know, this jobs have gotten a lot more dangerous. Some of these folks are also facing, you know, the threat of immigration enforcement. They, you know, don't have citizenship or, in some cases, legal status. You know, on top of sort of all the kind of physical demands of, you know, these really hard jobs that you're working at night. You know, in these, frankly, you know, really difficult, sometimes brutal, you know, outdoor conditions. I talked to Hector a little bit about this, and, you know, he actually kind of, you know, pushed back on some rhetoric that we see around immigration in the U.S.
El trabajo duro, el trabajo sucio, el trabajo que de repente el americano, el norteamericano natal no lo desempeña. Y también considerar que estas personas que viajan hacia allá viajan con un sueño, no viajan con la intención de dañar, ni de quitar, ni de robar nada. Van a darlo todo por su trabajo, por su familia.
You know, so he was basically saying these are hard jobs, these are, you know, dirty jobs. The kind of work that he did is what, you know, people who are born in the U.S. Won't do. And you know, people who immigrate to the U.S. travel here with a dream. You know, they don't want to break anything, they don't want to rob, they don't want to take anything. You know, they just want to give their job their all.
What are some of the questions that you're going to be asking going forward when it comes to these workers and their families, and what led to this situation?
You know, one really big question I have is, you know, was this preventable? Was there anything that could have been done? Again, we're talking about people who work in these really vulnerable situations. The Lieutenant Governor of Maryland, who's actually a traffic and transportation engineer by trade, by profession, she's talked a lot about, you know, measures that might help provide safety and additional support for, you know, construction workers who might work on the side of a highway. And, you know, in the days since the bridge collapse, she's sort of also been talking about how that maybe needs to include maritime safety as well, and sort of look at, you know, workers who work on bridges who might be impacted by ships and ports and that sort of thing. But it's really difficult, right? I mean, this is an industry. These are people who, you know, perform jobs that are sort of so vital to, like, maintaining America's crumbling infrastructure, yet they are also the ones who are most at risk. And I think that's one of the things that's, you know, beyond the sort of obvious tragic loss of life, is one of the things that's so horrible about all of this.
Teo, thank you so much for walking us through all of your reporting on this.
Thanks for having me on.
Teo Armas is a reporter for The Post. And as Teo mentioned, we have a lot of colleagues here at The Post who are continuing to follow this bridge collapse. For our latest coverage, go to WashingtonPost.com. Before we go, here's some other news that we've been watching today. Sam Bankman-Fried has been sentenced to 25 years in prison for stealing $8 billion from the customers of his cryptocurrency exchange. The sentence was handed down just this morning by a federal district court judge in Manhattan. Bankman-Fried is 32 years old, and he was the founder of FTX. He became kind of a celebrity and poster child for the promises of cryptocurrency. But when the company went bankrupt in 2022, people who invested their life savings in crypto lost their money overnight. After an investigation, charges were filed, and late last year, jurors found Bankman-Fried guilty of fraud, conspiracy, and money laundering. The federal judge who handed down the sentence today said that he believed Bankman-Fried had failed to take responsibility for the disaster that he created. His exact words were, quote, Mr. Bankman-Fried says mistakes were made, but never a word of remorse for the commission of terrible crimes, end quote. In addition to the 25-year sentence, Bankman-Fried has also been ordered to repay more than $11 billion. And it is officially opening day for Major League Baseball. All eyes are on Los Angeles Dodgers star Shohei Ohtani, who has recently been surrounded by a scandal involving his former interpreter and allegations of betting and theft. Last week, the Dodgers fired that Japanese interpreter, who also happens to be Ohtani's close friend, Ipe Mizuhara. The allegation is that Mizuhara had stolen millions from Ohtani to cover gambling debts. Ohtani recently addressed the matter, saying he was, quote, just beyond shocked. Ohtani was also adamant that he didn't bet on baseball. In the meantime, Ohtani is expected to play a starring role for the Dodgers, who started their regular season in Seoul but are now stateside again. They're facing the St. Louis Cardinals at Dodger Stadium as the 2024 season begins at ballparks across America. That's it for Post Reports. Thanks for listening. Today's show was produced by Renny Sparnovsky and Alana Gordon. It was mixed by Sean Carter and edited by Maggie Penman. Thank you also to Matt Zapatosky. I'm Martine Powers. We'll be back tomorrow with more stories from The Washington Post.
Hey, this is Christina Quinn. I'm the host of Try This, The Washington Post's new series of audio courses. The idea behind Try This is to become better functioning humans without having to comb the internet for countless hours. In our first course, we learned how to sleep better. Now, we're going to learn how to make our friendships stronger. I'll offer expert tips that are doable, and I'll keep it short. So let's do this. Classes in session. Find Try This from the Washington Post wherever you listen.